Les colloques du Collège de France.
Boris is a senior researcher at the Bibliotheca Arabica project in Leipzig. His main interest is the history of manuscript libraries and readers, and they are also the topic of his the Rifaya of Damascus book that he published in 2016. And that was also awarded the Anne-Marie Schimmel Forschungspreis in 2017. And with no further ado, we look forward to your presentation.
Thank you very much. As you may have guessed from this introduction, I am, like most of the other participants here, usually deal with books. Books that actually look like books, that means have multiple pages and are usually found between some sort of two covers. And I usually also don't dabble in art history. But today will be a little bit different, and I will start for a change, not with words, as I usually do, but with animals. These animals are, a hare and a lion, which are today found in the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. And some of you might have seen them before, they are quite famous. And they are part, as is widely known, and as I will argue in more detail, part of a book that is called Mantik al-Wahash. That's the title of the book. And if you never heard about that book and never read it, it is because that book has not survived until this day. But you may have seen those images already, because they have been exhibited widely, they have been printed all over the place, and they have been analyzed over and over again. And yet, there has been some fundamental confusion on the part of researchers about the nature of this fragment. I would like to hope to clear up some of those confusions along the line of the questions that I have laid out here. First, I mean, what is actually the nature of this leaf? Then what kind of work, if any, is the Mantik al-Wahash that is mentioned in here? And then lastly, I would like to explore why such a book has not survived until today. Maybe you're looking at this now and you ask yourself, hey, what's there to clarify? It's clear what this is. And I would certainly think so. When I looked at it, I thought I had a clear idea about what it is, but sometimes it still needs to, some of the things that may appear clear still need to be said out loud. And I think this is one of the cases. So this paper forms part of a group of papers that are widely called Fustat papers in research literature, and so this leads us to the question, is probably a hint, probably a misleading hint, but probably a hint to where this paper originally comes from. The Mantik al-Wahash that you've seen is not the only illustrated paper that ended up in museum collections all across the world, starting in the 50s of the last century, and as the name suggests, they are said to have come as a group from the Egyptian city of Fustat, which, as you know, is the first settlement of the Muslim conquerors of Egypt, and is obviously now today part of Cairo. This particular paper with the lion and hare was acquired by the Metropolitan Museum in the 50s, like so many others like it, and is said to be one of those Fustat papers. And the picture that I'm showing you here, you do see, these are all papers today in the Metropolitan Museum that are said to be part of the Fustat papers. So you can see there are a lot of illustrations on them, humans, but also animals. So it is that's the context in which we find our hare and the lion. Unfortunately, all of these do not come out of documented archaeological digs, so we can't really say anything about the context and the connection between them as a group. The question arises, obviously, was this just marketing? Were they marketed as the Fustat papers because that has a ring to it? Or were they really all found in one place? And if that one place was not just Fustat by and large, but maybe was a library, was a house? So we don't know any of this. Another possibility could be if finding all of those illustrations actually in the digs of Fustat could be that, yeah, the houses of Fustat by and large were filled with illustrated papers. Many people had them, right? So these are the questions that we can only answer with the right contextual information, which we do not have. But what is clear is that the lion and the hare are not a one-off exception. And the question then arises, what was this? Was this, what kind of, is this a tradition? Is this a, what is the social context of this? And how does that relate to book history? Is this maybe, as I would suggest, a tradition of illustrated books? We do find, obviously, illustrated, these kind of illustrated fragments, not only from the Fustat papers, which as a group are associated with the art market of the, as I said, the 50s and the 60s of the past century. We also find these examples, which come from the Papyrus Erzherzog Rainer collection in Vienna, which is one of the largest collections of papyrus in the world, which has much deeper roots. So this is a collection that came to Vienna already in the 19th century. So that was not Fustat. These have been excavations in mostly in the Fayum, actually, that come. So we see that this is something that is that definitely also comes from Egypt, but that we cannot solely associate with that place for start. Now we shall take a look at the question of what this really is. As I said in or as I've announced in this talk, this is I will treat this as a book, and this is actually how it is how it has been understood in research so far. But strangely, the same people who have asserted that this is a page from a book have also at the same time cast doubt on that. So we have here we have actually a lot of published research that goes pretty much along those lines of Jonathan Bloom here, where he he says yes, this should be a book, Mantiq al-Wahsh, by Ka'ab al-Ahbar. But at the same time, he says, no, like if you turn the page and then you see these strange notes, and how could this be a book? It should be a book, but it can't be from the materiality of it. This is actually what we find regularly in research. And this is obviously from a rather dated book of his, Art of the City Victorious, but he has most recently, just 1 or 2 years ago, has written another article in which he restates that even more forcefully, saying this page cannot be a book. It's because the verso just has no connection with the recto. And the same is... I left it in German, I'm sorry, but I... thing. Yeah, I have the translation here. The same as in this statement by Victoria Meinecke-Berg, who says the verso is more problematic. The text is unconnected to the previous page. It is entitled "The Book About the Dialogue of Wild Animals," followed by an obscure remark that could be translated as "beautifully illustrated," as if the page constituted a commentary. Despite the lack of connection between the two pages, so there is no connection for her, which one might rightly expect if it were a manuscript, the calligraphy and drawing appear to be from the same period and executed by the same hand. So what she is talking about is this, where she says, oh, this is a comment on the book that says, oh, it's nicely illustrated, right? And we find the same thing on the website of the Metropolitan Museum itself, so this is not the only text on this page on the website. They do assert that this comes originally from a bound book, but at the same time they also give evidence to the contrary, and they translate the inscription that we have just seen in the following manner. Kitab fihi mantaqat wahash, that is the title of the book, and the next line they transcribe as bi amr malih musawwar, that is by the order of Malih the illustrator. So that is obviously that has shaped how they understand the book, and that, by the way, that same information is also found in the printed catalog. So this is the standard and official announcement of what this is. Now, I would argue that very clearly what we do have here is, in fact, a book. And what we have here on this page there is the title page. This is so what we the interpretation that were given by these researchers that are cited are based on the understanding that the side with the lion is the rector side, and then you turn it around and have here the verso side. I would argue that, in fact, the opposite is true. What you have here is the title page. You have the title on top, Kitab fihi mantaqat wahash, and then you have a description of what this book is. Namely, it is complete, it is pleasant, and it is illustrated, which is what this must have been at some point. Now it's only a page or a leaf, but it must have been precisely that. And this is really in line with how title pages often work. You have this Kitab fihi something, and then after that, often you have an announcement about at least the completion of the text, or the complete nature of the text. As you have here in another book about animals, Kitab Manafi Ater, and you do see that people do stress it is complete. You know, there's this tamam, like in this other case we had the word tam, so you have ala tamam wal kamal. So this is nothing out of the ordinary, indeed. Such a remark is not out of the ordinary. I would say that I'm very likely not the first one to have looked at this folio and said, yeah, that this is a title page. You know, I'm standing here and thinking, you know, what I'm saying is pretty banal, but at the same time, sometimes banal things have to be said in order to be on the record, right? And still, I'm also probably not the first one to see it that way, because while researchers have been scratching their heads for decades about what this is and what these strange glosses on the back of the page would mean and anything, Ernst Grube, as far as I know, who is, as far as I know, the first to have paid attention to this piece, who was a curator at the Metropolitan Museum, he has written about this nearly 70 years ago. And from what he has written, it doesn't seem to me that he had any problem with this page. So I think that it doesn't say, oh, this is strange, this is a strange verso, anything. I would think that if you had asked him, what do you make about those glosses on the verso side, I think he would have said, but those are not glosses, this is a title page. He just found it super banal not to say it, I think. And I, yeah, I'm not claiming to be the first one to notice this here. Also shows you that academia, that new things in academia are not always better than old things. I think that was the easier part of my undertaking here, identifying that this is indeed a book. Now we have to turn to the question of what this was actually. So, and much more complicated because the text is fragmentary. As you can see, the first words do not still exist. There is very clearly the name Ka'b al-Ahbar on the in the first sentence. So, by the way, there's the Basmala, which also, you know, this is how a text starts, right? This is another proof that this is the beginning. Actually, Ka'b al-Ahbar is very clear for those of, I mean, I guess most of you would know who Ka'b al-Ahbar is. He's one, supposedly the first Jewish convert to Islam. He has he has been a source of all kinds of information about Jewish scriptures. And has been part of the first the first wave of conquests in Syria and has settled there. But he's always cited as a source of scriptural wisdom of the so-called Israeliyat. But to my knowledge, really not a part of. A source of any zoological or animal lore, right? The catalog of the Metropolitan Museum, however, positions the text firmly as a zoological, as well as quote zoological treatise with strong roots in the classical tradition, and that is tradition is defined by them as the scientific handbooks by literateurs just such as Al-Jahith and the physician Ibn Bukhtishur with his Manaf al-Hayawan. And we always read that it was this piece was actually authored by Ka'b al-Ahbar. However, as you've seen in the title, you do not actually see the name Ka'b al-Ahbar. So it's only he's mentioned as an authority here. But I would say that there is nothing here that would tell you that he would be that he would still be the authority on the next pages. Maybe we should. Skip to the next question. That is, when do actually animals actually talk? Because speech of animals is the topic of this work, and we have here several traditions. There is, of course, the Quran. Here, ants and birds do talk, but they do not talk the human language. It's just that Solomon can understand the speech of birds. We have the fable-like traditions like Kalila Udimna and the Suwan al-Mu'tah by Ibn Zafar, which is on which you can see on the left side. So they were often illustrated. On the right side, you can see a copy of the Rasa'il Ikhwan al-Safa, the pure brethren or brethren of purity. So you can, at least in this rare, unique copy, you can find animals in there too. We have the fables of Luqman. And one way to understand the fact that wild animals in these traditions do talk is a theory of species that has been developed and put forward by several Islamic theologians, philosophers, and historians, and recently been analyzed by Ignacio Sanchez with regard to the Rasa'il. And according to this view, animals originally, during the days of Adam in paradise, were perfectly capable of talking. But they lost this capacity with Adam's creation, either through their sin or to mark the specialty of humanity. So we could have here something that is akin to the fables of Luqman, in that it has an authorial name attached to it, who certainly never authored such a text. Right? So Ka'b al-Ahbar could then be take on the mantle of a general purveyor of wisdom, like Luqman, and be associated with these fables. But recently I actually learned of another literary vehicle for talking animals, and that is in the Qisas al-Anbiya, the stories of pre-Islamic prophets. Here, carp is actually a primary transmitter of these texts, and we have talking animals in those texts too. So that is a place where I have to dig deeper. It's not a tradition that I'm very familiar with. I will have to see whether carp al-ahbar is actually in this tradition someone that is associated with talking animals, and where we can have a textual tradition that I can identify with this leaf. I don't think we can do much with the text as it is very, very fragmentary, but we have to ask how, after hopefully establishing that we can probably have something here like a fable, a text that is probably like a book of fables and maxims that uses the authority of carp al-ahbar, we can now confront the question, the fundamental question, why do we not know about this work today? Even though a millennium ago someone thought it important enough to diligently produce an illustrated copy of it, there are a multitude of ways how books can get lost, obviously, and I just, in the interest of time, I would just concentrate on, so there's disinterest, you know, just you don't want to have a, you don't care for the book anymore, or you want to actively destroy a book, right? But when we're looking at where do those books go, when nobody wants them anymore, I just want to look at this tradition of recycling, especially the recycling in bindings, book bindings. So this has been a book binding in Leiden that has been opened up. And you see that all of this material in there, there's documentary material, letters, other kinds of documents, but you also find literary texts on those bindings. So if you would open up all of those bindings, you would find, in this case, the Einar Kodat's Essence of Reality that has a page of the text in here, and this is a very rare text, so, but still somebody didn't like it and destroyed a perfectly, what appears to be a perfectly fine copy of it, and put it in a binding. So there are lots of books that are still there. We can then ask ourselves, where do we find animals in the living environment of people? Obviously, people like to be surrounded by images, like in pottery, where you do find a hair, like in our manuscripts in Fatimid-era pottery, or as in this image on the carpet there, where people are sitting. So people like to be surrounded by animals, and I would think that what we would actually need would be images about images, you know, images where you see how images are integrated into daily life. That is something that from this time, unfortunately, we do not have from the Islamic period, which we have from the early modern European environment. What we do know is that images have been recycled in many different ways. Here is a modern way of the antiquities market that is obviously scandalizing to many people, including me, when you have a beautiful object, but you take it apart in order to make much more money, which Yael Rice has pointed out here. The images were meant to be enjoyed forevermore with text, the text that they actually illustrate, and when you cut folios out of books, it is like removing archaeological objects without recording their fine spots. Nonetheless, I would say this has always been done. Like, this is something that you can find in very prominently in the Dietz albums, and just for complete transparency, this is private collection. This is actually, these are mine, my images, my I like birds, and I like to have these kind of images that you can find in shops for them, and they're wonderful framed on the wall, but they come from books, you know, they cut up books in order to make them. So this is something that has always happened, the question I would ask is whether this can be, we can theorize that there was a context in which images like this would have been cut out of books, where purely textual pages might have gone to other forms of recycling while pages with images might have been used somewhere else, more visible. The question still stands whether the the large numbers of illustrated books, of illustrated pages in those Foustan papers and other museum collections, single pages, do speak to a tradition of the illustrated book that once existed, that is different than the high-end illustrated book that we use for, that we know from later periods. Like this is it's very small, it's very simple in its style and its calligraphy. I mean, it's very nice copies, but it's still very simple. Was this an illustrated book for the masses? Maybe that was really mass-produced. But which did not survive because those images were very attractive to people. For that, I think we would have to go through the museum collections of such images and see how many of them are actually part of books and how many of them are actually standalone images. And then we can see, we can ask this question to this material again. Thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.